you like listening to those ads, or would you rather hear an ad-free version of The Gist? Well, it's your lucky day, because in the lab, we've developed such an animal. It's like the vegan meat of podcasting. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com to become an ad-free subscriber, or choose from other tiers with additional bonus content. And they all taste like chicken. Enjoy the show. It's Monday, December 9th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The lion roars no more. Bashar al-Assad has fled to Russia. Damascus has fallen in the victory of Abu Mohammed al-Jolani, leader of the rebel group that took control of Syria, raises questions and concerns. Al-Jolani's group, Tahrir al-Sham, HTS it's called, were al-Qaeda affiliates. Wall Street Journal, bullet point, end of dictatorship threatens power vacuum in Syria. The exact nature of the threat? Michael Allen served on George W. Bush's National Security Council, laid it out on Fox.
Only celebrate for a minute, because ungoverned spaces breeds terrorism. It was already at least a partially ungoverned state. And even though I believe President Trump and others want to pivot on and do other things in the world, we may have to keep our boot on the throat of these al-Qaeda-like affiliates, ISIS-like affiliates.
Yes, prudent. It could all go wrong. Could it go worse than 600,000 dead and millions fleeing the oppressive Assad regime? Not likely. No matter how it goes, the departure of Assad, and Assad, by the way, is a nom de guerre, meaning lion, taken up by Bashar's grandfather. That departure is a good thing. And while the politics and alliances around Syria certainly are complicated, complicated doesn't mean unknowable. The two great winners in the region of this development are U.S. allies, Israel and Turkey. The rebels, upon taking homes, flew a Turkish flag immediately. Now Turkey and Israel, they themselves are adversaries with each other. And Turkey, though a member of NATO, is far from perfectly aligned with U.S. interests. All true. But a major principle is that when your enemies lose and your allies win, that is a good thing. And when we say the U.S.'s enemies lost in Syria, it's hard to overstate not just the scope of the loss, but the array of enemies. Syria was an enemy state. That's true. Syria's two largest backers propping up the mangy lion were Iran and their proxy Hezbollah, decimated and pushed back. The other benefactor was Russia, clear U.S. adversary. In fact, remember the axis of evil? That would be Iran, check, we talked about them. Ba'athist Iraq, Syria was the other Ba'athist state in the world, so they're implicated there. And North Korea, the Russians have outsourced their fighting to the North Koreans in Ukraine. So they're caught up in this too. Anytime one's adversaries can suffer such setbacks, it's got to be considered a win for one's own side. Consider the counterfactuals. If Iran were on the march and winning battles, if Russia were still seen as a potent force capable of propping up regimes, that would be terrible. Well, that terrible counterfactual is not the fact. And I know the foreign policy establishment likes to study things in depth, and I know that a static situation makes it easier to study, but I see what's going on in Syria as a good thing, so long as al-Jolani doesn't reveal himself to be the next, let's say, al-Baghdadi, leader of ISIS. But here's a sign that he won't be that. It's that he says he won't, while al-Baghdadi never veered from his ideology. In fact, al-Jolani even dropped his nom de guerre in favor of his real name, Ahmed al-Shara, in official communiques. Many of the most terrible actors of the world have always told the world exactly who they were. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard, the Islamicists in Iran, the Taliban. They always told the world that they wanted to be the Taliban. There was maybe a two-week period where they were ambiguous about their desire to fully oppress women. Now, by the way, women have been outright banned in Afghanistan from receiving any kind of medical training, nurses, midwives, anything. Fantastic. But the HTS rebels in Syria have shape-shifted over time. They're not one of these staunch ideological groups who gets its power by never, ever reforming. They're crafty. They're smart. They align themselves with the forces they perceive to be acting in their interests. I'm not saying that these rebels are going to be doing DEI training modules and trust falls anytime soon, but they seem more or less rational actors who realize they will get further by ingratiating themselves with the United States than by starting a new war. In any event, the experts are, in fact, right. Be cautious. Don't commit too early. Be aware of unintended consequences. But sometimes I wonder if the foreign policy establishment is so cautious they can't even recognize a win. And if they can't recognize it, they can't capitalize it. And you wonder sometimes if they're capable of making the next best moves if they're not seeing the chessboard clearly. Bye-bye, Bashir. Al-Jilani isn't perfect, but he's apparently not even Al-Jilani anymore. On the show today, Sharp Pivot, Department of Sharp Pivot. We will be joined for the rest of the show by Ben Silverman and Brian Baumgartner. Brian playing Kevin Malone on The Office, and Ben being the show's executive producer. The duo has collaborated on an animated Christmas book, The Night Before Christmas at Dunder Mifflin. We will talk all things Office next. Brian and Ben, joining me soon. I'm pleased to be joined by Brian Baumgartner and Ben Silverman. They are of The Office. Brian played Kevin. Ben was, well, actually, he had a role, but he was also an executive producer and one of the brains behind the show. And they're out with a book based on the beloved TV series, The Night Before Christmas at Dunder Mifflin. Brian, Ben, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us. I thought we were recording before. Your listeners just missed a big talk on education.
We solved Pell Grants.
We did.
We put our brains
theater
together.
Programs, just in, the arts.
In three minutes, we did that.
It was crazy. Ben came down for charter schools, and Brian came over the top and smacked him down in the name of unions. I don't know. Do I have permission to air that?
Or sure, yes. You can, for sure.
Volatile. Where's Betsy?
Okay, so I have, Ben, I do have questions for you, but I want to start off with two quick ones for Brian. Question one.
Yes.
What's the capital of Arizona?
Oh, my God. I can't believe that you, that is such like a deep, dark fade. I'm going to say Phoenix.
And my question to Ben is, do you know why I asked him that?
Oh. I don't. I'm not even connected to that one.
Go ahead, Brian.
Yes, I was on an episode of Jeopardy.
And the state capital is for 200.
Arizona, Tucson, Scottsdale, Phoenix. Brian.
What is Tucson?
I'm sorry, no. Tim.
What is Scottsdale?
Also incorrect. Lisa Ann, this just got a little easier.
What is Phoenix?
It is, in fact, Phoenix, yes. And you're in the lead.
Let me just say this. This is, I swear to you, this is a true story. On my way, because I have a drive, I don't live in Los Angeles proper anymore, I was talking to my sister, and I was like, you know, there's just so much potential for me to look like an ass here on the Jeopardy. And I specifically said, well, like, I knew all the state capitals at one time, but what, like, are, like, Delaware, is this going to come up? Or, like, New Hampshire, is this... And sure enough, she's like, oh, no, that will never happen. Sure enough, the capital of Arizona, which should be one. I got too tricky with it. That's all I have to say. I got too tricky.
Well, to be fair, first of all, your batting percentage was pretty good. I think I looked up the stats. You got something like 17 right and 3 wrong on the whole show.
Yeah.
So you did mostly.
It's all about the button.
It's all about the button. And to be fair, you'd think Phoenix would be the fake answer with city capital.
That's exactly right.
It's almost never the big
That's
city,
exactly
except,
right.
Of course, it's you do grow up in Atlanta.
Yeah. Usually there's an Albany.
Right.
Not exactly. Albany. It's not Los Angeles. It's not even San Francisco. It's not San Diego. It's Sacramento. So I was just like, oh. And here's the other thing is, they must not talk about it very much. Because, like, you're in Atlanta, and it's mentioned, there's the Capitol. Look at the beautiful dome. I don't know where the Capitol building is in Phoenix. I've been to, that's the thing, is I've been to Phoenix a lot. And I was, like, in that moment, I was like, never heard of that being the Capitol. Can't be that.
Also, to be very fair, and you might have a case, did they mean now or did they mean from 1868 to 78? In which case, Tucson, your answer would be
correct. Oh, wow. I love that detail.
Nailed it. Nailed it.
So, okay, now here's my second question. Okay. Ben, I'll let you field this question. This is an important one.
London.
And it's a literary one. What is, Ben, what is your second favorite poem written by Clement Clark Moore?
Oh, wow. You've nailed me. Thank you so much. To, you know, 'twas the day after Christmas. the boxing day poem. I need the second poem. What is it? What would it be?
I don't know. I think from what I understand of reading about him, the poem was written in or published in like the 1860s, and it was 13 years. It was anonymous. I don't know why it was anonymous. It was 13 years before anyone took credit. Yeah. It wasn't shameful or anything.
No, I mean, it's like, it's beautiful. What a strange thing to have not wanted attribution for.
And then he did, but then there was some sort of fight over whether he wrote it. But he is pretty much the founder of Chelsea, New York, or at least his family is. And he named, I didn't realize this until doing research for the show, he actually named all the reindeer. That was him.
Yes.
What a he's a Christmas icon.
Yeah. He's the guy.
I'll field that question.
Okay.
I will tell you specifically, I assume that another poem by Clement is also in the public domain. So let's just say that is a
book
is,
two.
Yeah, is another possibility. We'll find it. Old Santa Claus with much delight. Old Santa Claus with much delight. Because you asked Ben, I found that. I don't know. Is that a different one? I think it might be.
So how'd you guys decide to collaborate on this idea?
Well, we had collaborated on our previous book, which we got to be on your show and discuss, and is an awesome book, kind of talking about culture and how the show came to be, and with interviews that Brian initiated on his podcast, that is, you know, deeply actually kind of educational for anyone who wants to learn how a television show is made and how hits are made. And we had so much fun doing it, and also saw what a great response the audience had. But as Brian pointed out, as we were exploring this, it's really a gift for the fans. You know, it's something that they can take and actually own and keep in their house and have on their, you know, bedside table, or in this case, more like the kitchen table, because it's a family book. And the other thing that we were watching with the show is it continually had new young audiences. Unlike other shows that are kind of rewatched by the same fans of the original, this show gets younger and younger and gets discovered by the children of fans and now by the grandchildren of fans. And so we thought this would be a great way to kind of bring everyone together and connect to the show multi-generationally, just as they do watching it. And so we were very excited to bring it out, and we're seeing a really loving response. And Brian has done unbelievable work in the animated world and found our incredible illustrators who are brilliant Oscar winners. And yeah, I mean, why don't you tell them about that, Brian?
Yeah, I had the great blessing to work with Glenn Keane. Now, you may not know the name Glenn Keane, but Glenn Keane is an Oscar winner. He won the Oscar for Dear Basketball with Kobe Bryant. Prior to that, he was an animator at Disney. And as it has been explained to me, the old school animators at Disney were like responsible for a character when that thing. And so this is, he was the animator for The Beast. He was the animator for The Genie and Aladdin and Little Mermaid and all of these other things. And so I worked with him on this show, Trash Truck, which was on Netflix, which if you haven't checked it out, you probably don't have young kids. But it is beautiful. And that's what I kept saying to people when it finally came out. I was like, forget about my voice. Like, this is all about how it looks. And he and I became friends. And when we had the idea to do this, he was like my first, second, third, fourth, and fifth calls, which it took that many calls to get him to agree to help us out. He's incredibly busy. I'm not going to leave that for him to discuss, but he put us in contact, and he worked in collaboration with us, with Mael, our illustrator, artist, every step of the way. And that was the most fun for me, was being able to work with those guys in it's something I've never done before. Every week, having those meetings and talking about the illustrations, which I think in this are beautiful.
In Trash Truck, you play Walter, the big bear, right?
That's right.
Walter, wake up.
Well, what? Huh?
How are you whistling?
Doing what?
Whistling.
What's whistling?
Bears.
And you say he did The Beast, and he did, what was the other one that you named?
Well, so he, in all of those, so, you know, you have like the original Disney, right, which is like Snow White and
right.
all of that. So he was in that the Renaissance, right? So Little Mermaid, Aladdin, The Beast.
Right. He did Aladdin. He did. These are big, large, actual endomorphic characters,
yes.
as are you. Is that his specialty? The big characters.
I don't know. That's a really interesting question. I don't know if he would define it that way, but his imagination is incredible. And before he even agreed to say yes, we had about an hour phone call. I was actually away with my family, and I am pacing in the snow in Wyoming as he's talking to me, and he's literally talking about character traits from the characters of The Office and going through each character and identifying that, which is like, so what is the trait of this character? What could we latch onto to not imitate, but to exaggerate and
right.
focus, just the whole process of that is amazing. I have trouble with stick figures and like yeah. houses with windows aligned properly when I'm drawing. So it was just so interesting.
Shadowing.
To me. Shadow. Yeah.
So what did he say to illustrate figuratively and literally, and also literally figuratively, really sorry about that verbal cul-de-sac there, but what did he do to bring out and illustrate character traits of these characters who you've both known for many, many years that maybe you never saw, but as soon as he said it or as soon as your discussion led to it, it was really illuminating to you, maybe even about Kevin himself.
Well, yeah. One thing he started with is being a fan of the show. That's why he did it.
Yes.
So he was wildly yes. familiar with these characters and had been an avid watcher. So understanding their kind of texture and nuance and dimensionality was something that he came to readily. And I think that's why he was willing to do it, frankly.
That's right.
You know, so that helped kind of amplify the truths behind these characters in their animated or illustrated format. And when you have the book and you see the book, you're going to immediately recognize them, but obviously also in illustration there's some caricature, and so somebody's nose may be bigger than normal, somebody's eyes may be droopier than normal, and you may have that kind of physicality over amplified, but it relates to character. And one of the things the show mm-hmm. was so extraordinary was how good our actors were. I always talk with Brian about the murderer's row of performers on the show and how deeply they embedded these characters, and these characters became family for the audience, but also family with each other, but also their texture and depth and growth was really, really cool. And so I think you get a lot of that from Glenn's relationship to the show.
Yeah. And just specifically, you know, I'll just talk about Kevin for a second. I mean,
what do you know about Kevin?
Angela's cats are cute. So cute that you just want to eat them. But you can't eat cats. You can't eat cats, Kevin.
Well, no, but in terms of, I don't know that it was something that he told me that I didn't know, but there's a way that and part of it is Kevin in our story does take a particularly childlike role within it. And the way that he talked about the expression, the movement, which is so bizarre, right? Because it's a still image. There is literally no movement. But when you look at his drawings, you see the movement, which lends itself to be childlike or something. It's very difficult to understand. I will share with you this little story, which I can't even remember now in all of these conversations we've had about the book that Ben and I talked about it. But when Trash Truck ended, he did a drawing for all of the people who did voices. So he did a drawing of Walter the Bear. And Trash Truck is about a boy who his best friend is a trash truck. So his other friends are animals that would live around maybe a dump or a trash truck, a bear, a raccoon, a mouse, whatever. And so he did a drawing of Walter that was around a bunch of trash. And he had like four Easter eggs, including like little cans of chili, like embedded into the drawing. And I wasn't even fully aware of what a fan he was, but he had created this. It's now on the wall of my office. It's one of my treasured possessions.
That's amazing. I think that when you get a character and can bring out core characteristics, it shows you how rich and deep and textured the characters are. But also, and Ben and Kevin, you can both speak to this. Sorry, Ben and Brian, you can both speak to this. There we go. There's something iconic about a lot of the Office characters. And so they are multifaceted, but they're also of a type and they are consistent within their type. And that is the sort of thing I find that makes for great characters. And it's leading me to another point, but is there something about when you guys in the writer's room were talking about it, the iconography of some of the office workers?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we looked at, you know, there was a British show before it that informed it. And we realized we had to make it for the American vernacular. We had to make it for the American office and those kind of people that, you know, if you work in an office, and I've had the privilege and the pain of working in an office for throughout my adult life, is that you do have people who, you know, are phoning it in. You do have people who are overly passionate. You do have people who are still looking to be the teacher's pet, but in this case, within the office world. So there's absolutely types that permeate the real world that you look to connect to, because specificity is so important in both comedy and storytelling. So I felt like you see a lot of that, and hopefully you recognize a lot of those people. You have your Dwight, you have your Kevin, you have, actually there's not a lot of people like Kevin, but you have a lot of those elements within it. And then you have guys like Daryl. Like, I think the upstairs downstairs of the show is so deep, you know, the kind of various arenas that people work within,
right,
the workplace, right, is really cool.
And it's also such an inversion of what we would usually think about
who's the smartest
together.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
No,
yes.
And we reverse it 100%. And then you can weave in things that are like, we're taken out of the discourse, but around, it's a much easier and better way to kind of deal with the real world challenges that people have. Like, you know, who is the smartest guy? Why is he there? Why is the other guy there? What are the advantages people show up with when they step into a work life?
We'll be back in a minute to talk more with Ben Silverman and Brian Baumgartner of and about The Office. We're back with Brian Baumgartner and Ben Silverman. They've written The Night Before Christmas at Dunder Mifflin. And right before the break, we were talking about unexpected characteristics of actual people when they show up in an office. And in this part of the interview, I began by asking them how much the writers of the show took from the actors on the show, personality traits and character details. And then actors, of course, bring things, maybe things of themselves, to their characters. But was that more embraced on The Office than in other shows you've done or worked
with? Oh, 100%. I mean, it's taking centuries-old comedic types and translating it into the current world, and exactly what Ben is talking about. So it's these characters in one form or another have existed for generations, literally. But with the specificity that Greg brought to this, I mean, look, this is ultra realism, right? Like, this is in a way like intended to be more realistic than reality television shows, because the way that people look, the way the camera moves around, the what it's capturing is what makes the show. And the other thing that makes the show is, and this came from Greg. Greg worked on SNL. It was really important for him to have that collaborative process, which I think for Ben and other people made it really difficult in terms of the amount of time it took to film and very expensive. But like, he wanted the writers performing. He gave opportunities for the actors to write, or to, in my case, direct. Like, he wanted conversations to happen up in the writer's room, you know, before every season. And then when, you know, a particular important arc was coming up or something needed to be discussed. I mean, there really was no boundary. And when you compare that to other television shows where literally there is a boundary because the writers now sometimes aren't even in the same city, but even before that were, you know, maybe they had offices at Universal and you were shooting at a lot in Culver City. And if you're not familiar, those are 20 to an hour apart, 20 minutes to an hour apart. So you're not walking next door into Greg Daniels' office or the writer of the episode's office or to the writer's room or to the editing bay and having a conversation about how something worked or didn't work or what we could do forward. So that was very unique for this experience.
Well, and also Brian can shoot a basketball and hit a golf ball. He is a world-class athlete. And you saw that as he hit that shot in one shot.
Yeah.
Well, what about the cadence and the speech, which people hearing you now maybe wouldn't guess that this is how you
that
talk?
That he got a scholarship to one of the great schools in America? you didn't expect Kevin to be a scholarship recipient?
Well, I mean, look, the initial breakdown, right? So when a part posts to audition for, I'll never forget it, because we joked about it, me with my manager at the time. The breakdown said, the only thing spectacular about Kevin is that he is spectacularly unspectacular. And so the joke between my manager and I was, how do you pitch this to a casting director? I've got a guy who is so unspectacular.
You have to just experience the charismatic void.
He is so unspectacular. But look, it ran for 10 years. So things develop. And so, you know, what started, and part of what Ben was talking about in terms of bringing over the British version, you know, there were, you know, an equivalent for Jim and Pam and Michael and Dwight and Ryan, the intern. And then other than that, it was really just Stanley and Kevin that came directly. So the character of Keith was the original.
Keith Bishop, right?
That's right.
Became Kevin Malone.
Correct.
And those were one of the, there were people in the background that maybe you could find connections with.
Correct.
But yes, he was there all along as a type.
As a type. So it was, so it's, that's where it started, right? And then where was it going to go? And I think that the writers fell in love with, as we began working, the childlike sensibility of Kevin, and so, you know, look, they did 13 episodes and we did 207, and that was a big part of it for Greg. Originally, Greg wanted to do 207, and so he wanted a deep bullpen of people. So those were not just add-ons here, you know, Angela and Meredith and Phyllis, and I mean, he wanted more stories to be able to be created. And so intentionally, you know, he made it bigger. They didn't have someone specifically that they had to those characters that they were adapted from. So we started with Keith and then we went our own way.
When did you or anyone figure out that there was an overlap between Kevin and Cookie Monster?
I mean, it was all just sort of gradual in a way. I mean, you know,
you weren't channeling him. He wasn't a source inspiration. He wasn't on your vision board.
He was not. But I have to tell you, Mike, like, I think that, you know, for me, the whole experience, I mean, I didn't know Ben Silverman before this. I had just moved to Los Angeles 3 months before. I was a theater guy. This is what we were discussing before the show. Like, I was a theater guy. So for me, the idea, and by the way, the two people in the cast who came primarily from theater were me and Rainn Wilson, who played Dwight. And I think you can, I mentioned that because I think you can see some similarities. For me, the idea when creating a character, physicality, voice, posture, wardrobe, shoes, like all hair, all of those things, for me, as someone who came from the theater, that's a part of it. Like that's an intentional part of, you know, Kevin made, as Ben just mentioned, 13 baskets in a row from 15 feet extended. That was Brian, by the way, more than Kevin. But like, if you notice, and these are things I don't expect you to notice, but he was wearing a suit. I was wearing a sport coat, which I never took off in every single scene. And we discussed it because, again, as you're creating these archetypes and then you're finding that ultra realism within it, there is an archetype for Kevin that's existed throughout sitcom lore forever, right? And there would be ketchup down the front of his shirt, probably a little too tight, untucked, like disheveled, like not put together. And I was like, well, what if that isn't the kid? Like, what if he's wearing a suit coat and a tie and Dockers and he's doing his best? And his best may not be great, but that's his best. And he makes an effort and he shows up. And again, trying to create contradictions from what you would expect in a quote unquote Kevin character. To me, that's the life. Those are the things that you continue to find. Not so much about Kevin wearing a coat all the time, but those things, they enter your consciousness and bring a richness that you just don't find most of the time.
It's probably crazy for me to tell you guys this, but there's this theory of comedy that what is comedy other than benign violations? So, you know, in every knock-knock joke, there is a twist or a turn. And with a character like Kevin, the benign violation is you think he'd be a slob and would be terrible at sports, but boom, he nails 15 in a row.
Correct.
Correct. But another great thing to compliment you in the show is that the reason we were allowed to experience that was 207 episodes, but also the daring of the writers. Usually there are stock characters who are in the background and maybe given a line and are just used for he's this guy and he does this thing and he does this thing always.
Yes.
Right. Humor as, and this is another theory of comedy, that they are a blank machine. You know, he is a slovenly machine. This guy is a lust machine. She is a fret or worrying machine. But with The Office, because they tried to, and you tried to make it more real, you know, we saw them as real people and we actually got comedy out of that. And that's not always the easiest thing, right? You usually, comedy writers, you tell me, Ben, want to have 100 jokes for the slovenly guy, and that's fun to write. But if you make the slovenly guy not slovenly, it's a little
bit.
Well,
you also have to remember the form of this show. It was a, you know, no audience. Right. So you were used to these three camera proscenium kind of shows where you laughed before the character, you know, actually spoke a word. The character would arrive and you laugh because they wore that lust engine or that fret engine that you discuss. And they were caricature and they weren't real. And it frankly wasn't smart. Right. It was just like an easy play and an easy way.
Well, I mean, they They could be. At the epitome of the form, Carla from Cheers or Norm from Cheers, you'd Cheers, cut to them, you'd get the laugh.
Cheers yeah. and Norman Lear, you know, with parentheticals. Like, obviously, the great ones were exceptional. But you really, in general, had a whole sequence of very mundane from a intellectual level and from a kind of comedic masterpiece level coming out through the 80s, 90s, and aughts. And mm-hmm. and we really, because we were no laugh track, no audience, faux documentary, this ability to kind of go where the camera went and to go into these characters with more depth and also in turn to showcase them with more depth, to give them a broader life, to have three dimensions to them. And I think it's one of the reasons people fell in love with the show, because they felt smart, like they were in on that character's deeper side. They were in on that moment. And so I think people felt like they owned that. It was also post the era of like Baywatch and beauty being the defining factor of every show. And here was a show that kind of showcased you know, the ordinary things in such a way. You know, Brian always talks about the last line of the show and how we connect to the beauty in these ordinary things and these regular people, you know, these people that we know but have fallen in love with, but actually they're exceptional. And then we show you how they're exceptional. Creed was in a rock band, you know, Kevin can do X, you know, you discover all of these secret talents that hopefully we all possess, you know, that are more to us than just the version of us that you may see in the office, which is one version of us.
Right, right. It's very humanistic and very uplifting. But let's, just for a second, tell me about if it was hard to evolve to that place. Because I'm thinking of great sitcoms. We mentioned Cheers. But take Taxi. So in Taxi, I'm sure you'll... Right, such a great, well-written sitcom. Couple of the characters were allowed dimensions. Judd Hirsch, Alex Rieger was, and Elaine Nardo was. But then you need Lotka being funny foreign man, and you need Louis being the mean guy in the cage. Right, and you need Tony Danza being the dumb guy. And over the 10 years or whatever, 7 years of that series, each of the ancillary characters maybe got one personality trait that was a little surprising. But you guys totally blew that away. And my question is, was that always intended from the start? Was there like a fight with the suits at NBC, of which I think you became one, right, Ben? But, you know, was that hard to do and accomplish or even conceive?
Do you know what? Once we started to get momentum, there wasn't as much pushback on the creative because it was all so fresh. The original cycle of the show, there was so much resistance and there was so much pain to get even an episode ordered or two or three. You know, there were so many moments that we were like, fine. It was like you know, somebody kind of passive aggressively being like, fine, do what you want. You know, like, yeah, this will be over soon enough and we can move back to our normal style of television and comedy. You know, this will fail, you know, but we're giving you this shot as long as you do it for less money and with less resources. But then over time, as it started to pick up momentum, they started to be like, oh, maybe these guys know what they're doing. And they gave us a little more runway to do it. But I do think all along, Greg and the writing staff were like, we want to service these characters, many of whom were the writers, right? Mindy Kaling was a writer. BJ Novak was a writer. Paul Lieberstein, who played Toby, was a writer. So you also had them in that room wanting to service their own agenda as well and their own little portion of The Office, right? You had the portion where Jim and Dwight battled. You had the front end of The Office. You had the kind of headquarters. You had the accounting department. So there were all of these little pockets of shows within shows that could be serviced. You had the warehouse. And so all of that really opened up these little set piece zones for work and comedy and character depth that I think are so profound and work so well in the show. And I think as part of the reason it became so successful, it wasn't the normal five characters and that's it, that were the kind of CBS comedies and the others that we new on ABC. This was a hallmark also of NBC. NBC was the place that had Cheers. It was the place that had these kind of St. Elsewhere and Hill Street Blues. You know, it came out of that history where you could really do more adventurous stuff.
Yeah. And do you think there are many reasons it's beloved, the acting, the writing, but two of the reasons are people's connection to the characters. But it just occurred to me as you were talking, The Office built lore and they engaged in world building. And that's actually where TV went, right? If people talk about the world building of TV, they'll probably think of, I don't know, Westworld or some prestige show HBO. But man, did The Office, you could have a map, a big sprawled out map of the Scranton of The Office.
Well, we did not only that, did webisodes all in the accounting office with a murder, like during our summer after our first season. And Brian actually won an Emmy for those. We did a thing called the Dunder. We basically did this Dunder Mifflin, you know, infinity thing online. We were one of the first to have our characters in character on Facebook and MySpace as it launched, and to kind of showcase them in greater depth. And we had our actors actually writing in character to their characters' profiles. We did all of this work to kind of further ground this and showcase it in really unique ways that was absolutely what Game of Thrones did years later.
Yeah, and I do want to say, Mike, you bring up an interesting point in terms of building the world. And my podcast, which then became the first book that Ben and I did together, Welcome to Dunder Mifflin, Greg talked to me about this. And so the only episode that is a direct, American version, but the episode is essentially the same, was the pilot. And Greg and I talked about that. And he said there were a couple of reasons. One, he thought if the words were the same as the British and the British was a success, he'd get less notes from the network. So that was one. But two, he wanted to...
Like, what do you know?
Exactly.
Ripping off the BBC and then these Americans were like, they are British.
Exactly. But two, he wanted to spend that time on building the world. And through the whole first set of episodes, again, this is not cheap. This is more expensive. All of the actors were at our desks at, let's call it 7 a.m. before we shot, and they would shoot 30 minutes of B-roll, which means 30 minutes of us sitting at our desks working. Non-scripted, little exchanges. Sometimes it would make it in, sometimes it wasn't. But what it did do was it built the architecture of the space and what people were doing, not in a performative way, in a very, again, that sort of ultra real way. And so to bring it back to the book, because this is one of the things that I talked to the illustrators about when the first drafts came in. They were beautiful. They were great. And I said, guys, I can't tell where we are. Where is this drawing? And I talked to them about how important for me the architecture of Dunder Mifflin was, because most people who are reading this book understand where it is. And sure enough, the very first image now in the book, as we're entering the book, we're entering Dunder Mifflin, and you see Pam at her desk and Michael's office and the painting on the wall and Jim and Dwight's clump and then everything sort of in the background, but you immediately see the architecture. And then halfway through the book, he was like, oh, this is what you want? Well, then I'll give it to you. And he does an aerial shot from above with a bunch of stuff going on where you literally see the layout in plain sight there. And again, was he doing it like, oh, you're going to keep giving me notes about the architecture? Well, here it is. And so he went in, Mael went in and was like, would watch the show to make sure he had the right angle, the right perspective, of his drawing within the space, because that was so important to me, because I knew that would be so important to our fans.
Right. And that is why this book is not just an example of let's strap the jumper cables up to the corpse of the dead body and try to get 10 more volts of juice out of it. This is the sort of thing where I sense that fans just want to connect again to these characters that they love. And I can hear now that you guys really enjoyed revisiting.
Yeah. And, you know, the last thing I'll say about that is, you know, it was as Ben said before, it was a gift. But, you know, it came out of a real thing that I kept hearing from people interacting with me on social media or in person, was that, you know, whereas when I was a kid, it was the Grinch and it was Frosty and the Rudolph, you know, those.
Yeah, the Rankin-Bass iconic stop motion.
Correct.
Christmas specials.
And right. And then, you know, A Christmas Story and Elf, you know, it starts to evolve. And what I kept hearing was, you know, The Office means so much to our family. You know, when I go home for the holidays, we watch The Office Christmas episodes. Like, that has become our family tradition. Those episodes are special, not just to us, but I know to a bunch of the fans. And so really setting it here at Christmas, putting it is meant to give a gift for people who not only love the show, but are participating and using it during the holiday season.
The name of the book is The Night Before Christmas at Dunder Mifflin, and it's co-written by Brian Baumgartner and Ben Silverman. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Mike, thank you. Appreciate it.
And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pasquez, CBSO. And Leo Baum's our intern. Little out of order there. It's no. The rankings do not reflect anything except who gets the first round bye. That'd be the quaint Matlerts. Umpru G Peru Do Peru, and thanks for listening.